You're listening to On Shifting Ground. I'm Philip Yun, filling in for Ray Suarez. So what challenges should Americans expect will be part of our 24-hour news cycle in 2023, despite the fact that Congress is more polarized than ever? Chris Tuttle argues we're going to see more consensus from both parties on key foreign policy issues, especially in attitudes towards China. Chris leads the Renewing America initiative at the Council on Foreign Relations. Ray Suarez sat down with Chris a couple of weeks ago.
Welcome to On Shifting Ground.
Thanks, Ray. It's great to be here.
Dominating the recently concluded midterm elections were a long list of domestic issues: inflation, interest rates, worker pay, rising violent crime in some places. Only a few of the top issues even implicated foreign policy: problems at the border, supply chain challenges, the Ukraine war driving energy costs. What would you have liked to see candidates talking about involving the rest of the world that they simply weren't talking about?
Well, I think there was some conversation about Ukraine. I think actually the Ukraine conversation is a useful one to have, and it's actually politically pretty viable for candidates to have. The majority of the American people still support our support for the Ukrainians in the war. And I think it's actually an important question that speaks not just to the Ukraine issue, but speaks to broader issues of what the world is going to look like 10 or 20 years from now in terms of revisionist powers like Russia, potentially China, versus really what is the traditional West. So I think that's an important one that should have been talked about more. I also think that trade is sort of has become a third rail, no-touch issue, but I think it is an important one and something that is implicated in some of the supply chain and inflation issues that we've seen that were top of mind for voters, helping voters to understand that a lot of those issues play into their direct concerns.
Well, when Ukraine did come up among Republican candidates, quite often, it was to cast doubt on the Biden administration's continuing commitment to aiding Ukraine, helping Ukraine fight off the Russian invasion. Support for Ukraine has been bipartisan, but during the fall campaign, a not insignificant number of GOP candidates were talking about reining in American support, saying it's not open-ended, not permanent. Will the new speaker, Kevin McCarthy, or someone else, have such a narrow majority that he or she can't afford to lose even a few votes over this issue? Is this a weird way that domestic political concerns are going to inform the way we talk about a big foreign policy issue?
I don't think that McCarthy is actually going to have that difficult a time managing this issue and maintaining assistance to Ukraine. Now, it is true that in the sort of cleanest vote there was on the Ukraine supplemental appropriation, about a quarter of Republican House members voted against that. And they did that for various reasons. Some were procedural, some were, you know, sort of the Ukraine was a misprioritization of funds. But actually, you've got the vast majority of Democrats who are supportive of continued assistance to Ukraine. And you have a majority of Republicans who are supportive of assistance to Ukraine. So with that, you may have some loud voices within the party who oppose assistance to Ukraine, or don't necessarily oppose it, but at least say it's a misprioritization of taxpayer dollars. But you can put together a pretty solid coalition within the House to be able to do that. Now, the question about how tenuous his speakership is another one entirely. I think that is a genuine question that will make the issue difficult to manage if his speakership is threatened over and over again.
Is some of this a matter of framing? You mentioned supply chain issues. Are there indeed many issues that we think about as domestic issues that are deeply enmeshed in foreign policy conversations at the very top, at the cabinet level, but the way voters, taxpayers, rank-and-file American citizens think of them are much closer to home?
That's exactly right. And you see a lot of the things that we have done over the past several years on China, for example, the things that the tariffs and other sort of punitive efforts against China have actually had significant economic implications here in the United States. And you can make a pretty good argument that they've been inflationary. So there is definitely that connection. And I think that it's important to inform voters of those things, that, you know, going so hardcore on China is going to have real blowback here in the United States. And I think it's important that voters understand that, given that so many of them are just sort of China is bad. There is an argument to be made that we need each other. And I think that voters need to understand that.
It is an article of faith among a certain branch of the Republican Party that Biden has really gone easy on China and Donald Trump was tough on them. After the 1-2-3 punch of the Pelosi visit to Taipei, chip sanctions, that is, restrictions on sale of the most advanced microchips to China, and Biden's statement on Taiwan, well, they really riled, I can tell you, from this side of the Pacific, they really riled up the Chinese. It didn't seem like the Biden administration was going very easy on China at all.
Yeah, I have to agree from a policy standpoint. I think that probably a lot of those complaints are more tonal in nature. And Donald Trump was, you know, out there every day saying he was going to really stick it to the Chinese. The Biden administration has been more subtle in their rhetoric, but they've maintained the Trump tariffs. They've passed what amounts to a massive industrial policy bill with the help of Republicans that really takes some of the technology sector back for the United States or works toward that. So I think it's a hard policy argument to make that the Biden administration has been soft on China. I think that when you hear from those voices within the Republican Party, I think a lot of that is rhetorical and tonal.
Recently, Joe Biden met with Xi Jinping, and the two are reported to have lowered the temperature a little bit in the bilateral, that the two men had a very long talk during the G20. Is it really the G2? And should Americans be a little bit more invested, a little bit more aware of what goes on between these two giant economies? Would this be one area in particular where it might make a lot more sense for normally domestically driven Americans to pay more attention to what's going on in the rest of the world?
Absolutely. The United States and China, even though China is a, you know, near peer competitor and in some cases a genuine threat, we are inextricably linked. And all this talk of decoupling and sort of an oversimplification of the China issue by both parties, because it's very easy as a member of Congress, right? When you see the numbers about how the United States feels about, you know, people in the United States feel about China, they have, I think that one of the descriptions in one of the Pew polls is very cold, and it's, you know, numbers in the sort of 80% range. But I think that people need to understand how linked we are and that decoupling is not really a realistic option. It's finding a more balanced option. My concern, and I wrote this in a piece recently that I think you read, is that there is risk in the next Congress that we are going to oversteer on China and we are going to be doing things that are needlessly provocative and sometimes will create self-inflicted injuries.
One area that seems to be pretty low-hanging fruit that the United States has de-emphasized is the sort of person-to-person relationship that happens when a Chinese student comes to the United States for 4 years to study. Recently, I was talking to the consul general in Shanghai, and it turns out that, yes, driven by pandemic concerns, driven by various other factors, but also driven by Trump administration hostility, at least in rhetoric and tone toward China, the ratio of American students studying in China and Chinese students studying in the United States is way out of whack. Many times more Chinese are coming to the United States, but that number is way, way down. And during the Trump years, there was an attempt to make it harder to stay in the United States after you complete your education. Arguably, taking some of the best, young, freshly trained talent off the table for the American economy. This is one way that that normal people actually meet people from other countries when they come here to live during their young adult years. Are we making a mistake there? Do we really need to re-examine the way people actually meet each other and talk to each other and the links? I mean, Xi Jinping himself famously spent a year as a student in Iowa and got to know the United States that way.
That's right. And Terry Branstad ended up being our U.S. ambassador to China as a result of that visit. Well, I'd say a few things. One, this goes both ways. I think that the number of American students that are being permitted into China, I think, is down as well. And that may be because of actual government controls or just because of the environment that has been created by Xi. The other thing is there have been problems with bringing, in some cases, bringing Chinese young people over here in terms of some of the concerns about espionage and those kinds of things. But I think your premise is right. It's those people-to-people connections, as demonstrated by the Xi Jinping-Terry Branstad relationship, for example, are extremely important. And we do need to figure out ways to foster those kinds of relationships on a more wholesale level, to the extent we can do that without creating genuine national security concerns.
Large numbers of people are still thronging the U.S. border. And the mix of who's trying to gain entry has changed in an interesting and significant way. It's not just Mexicans. It's not even close to just Mexicans. A record number of Cubans have made their way to Mexico and now no longer guaranteed entry to the United States from the so-called wet foot, dry foot immigration policy. They're still taking their chances. They go to Yucatan, which is very close to Cuba, has visa-free entry for Cubans, and then they make their way to the border and ask for entry. Ukrainians are heading to the southern border of the United States with Mexico, a surging number of Africans, people fleeing natural and man-made disasters in other parts of Latin America. With a Republican House, will the border inevitably be getting more attention? And can we hope for more thoughtful, serious attention? Or is it going to be, do you anticipate, a more demagogic kind of attention?
Well, I think you can count on it that it's going to get a lot more attention in the new Republican-controlled House. It depends on how it's managed. I don't have great level of confidence that it's going to be managed in a way that is not over-politicized. But there is a serious problem at the border. And I think that both sides recognize that, but both sides can't quite get to the point where they can strike some sort of reasonable agreement to get serious immigration reform. Now, we're seeing right now a bill that was introduced by Tom Tillis, Republican, and Kyrsten Sinema that actually does a pretty good job of threading that needle. But both sides are so entrenched that I don't see that, you know, we're hoping to move that during the lame duck. And in the new Congress, I don't think that's going to happen either. But you can count on the border getting additional attention. And there's a reasonable case to be made for the border to get more attention. The question is how it's done and if it feeds into some sort of broader agreement where we can finally put the issue in a place that is much better than it has been.
Does that new mix of aspiring refugees tell us something about the state of the world? Is that human throng at the southern border in places like El Paso and Nogales, Tijuana, San Diego, really an illustration of the problems of the broader world, not just of a bilateral relationship with Mexico?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, you can say what you want about the negativities of the Cold War, but it was a stabilizing influence that, since it has gone away, has created enormous chaos. And you're seeing that all around the world. And you're seeing that in the mix of people who are showing up at the U.S. border, trying to either get away from political persecution, which is, you know, sort of your traditional asylum seeker route, or simply trying to get away from violent crime in their countries, or, you know, disasters that have set countries back, you know, year after year for decades.
One domestic issue that is intrinsically a foreign policy issue is the price of energy. And if you listen and watch the messaging on foreign affairs coming out of both GOP and Democratic circles in the last year, there's argument with Joe Biden over the handling of the Russian invasion, the U.S.-Saudi bilateral relationship, especially since the announcement of OPEC's intention to cut oil production, second-guessing the administration on loosening the embargo against Venezuela, to act as a hedge against rising petroleum prices, on the use of the Strategic Oil Reserve. So a lot of foreign policy issues end up pressing one way or another, both on the price of oil and on domestic politics as a result. Gas is now down to the pre-invasion price. Is this really simply a price-sensitive foreign policy conversation? Will this go away if gas continues to get a little cheaper?
No, I don't think it will, because I think that the Biden administration is a bit hamstrung by the rhetoric of the Biden administration versus the actions of the Biden administration. So on the one hand, Joe Biden is talking about, you know, during the campaign and during his first year in office, ending fossil fuels and talking about getting rid of coal and even some of the actions they've taken when it comes to, for example, the recent COP negotiations and all that. There's a strong environmental thread that rolls through the Biden administration. At the same time, they're asking people who they have in many cases vilified to pump more oil to get oil prices down. I think that once those prices go down, there will be continued efforts on part of the Biden administration on the environmental side. And I think that's going to continue to foster a lot of debate during campaigns.
Is there a gap between rhetoric and actual on-the-ground policy implications? I mean, I keep hearing, for instance, that Joe Biden has stopped the flow of oil. And while, yes, not granting any new exploration leases, there are tens of thousands of leases still outstanding and able to be drilled and able to be exploited. The United States day-to-day is producing as much oil as it was in 2019 and 2020. I wonder if some of this is a gap between actual crude coming out of the ground and the tone that comes from the White House itself. The United States has hardly unilaterally disarmed in the production of energy.
No, that's certainly true. We have not unilaterally disarmed, but campaigns are run on a lot of those rhetorical issues. And there is, you know, the Keystone Pipeline, for example, and the resultant price increases, even though Keystone wasn't online, and the sort of general tone of the Biden administration when it comes to energy policy makes them an easy target when gas prices do go up, even by a small amount, for their political opponents to say, look, this is what they would like to do.
When Joe Biden came to the White House, lots of experts were looking at the way the U.S. pulled out of an arms limitation treaty with the Russians, out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which took years to negotiate, out of the Paris Climate Accords, and wondered if the United States could be relevant, could remain important in world councils, if it was seen by mid-sized states, by mid-sized economies, as a no longer reliable partner in alliances, a no longer reliable partner in treaties that can be worked out by one White House and then have the rug pulled out by the next. Joe Biden came to the White House promising to bring America back. Did he do it? Has he done it?
I think Ukraine has shown that the United States is still the global leader. I think that Joe Biden, certainly by coming into office, saying those kinds of things and, you know, pledging to rejuvenate alliances, I think has been important. He's also had strong Republican backing as well. You know, the multilateral commitment to multilateral internationalism and things like NATO never really left the rank and file of the Republican members of Congress. So I think it's been an effort by both sort of internationalists within the Republican Party and Joe Biden. To your question, did he do it? I don't think so. And that's not a knock on Joe Biden. It is more a question of when, for example, the Japanese saw what happened during the Trump administration, their thinking, well, what happens 2 years from now? Are we going to get something similar? Are we going to get Donald Trump again? You people change, you know, your presidents potentially every 4 years. And as proven in 2016, we don't know what we're going to get. So I think that's going to take a longer process, a longer term, a set of both Democratic and Republican presidents who come into office and are clearly committed to those things.
In 30 years as a Washington journalist, I've had repeated conversations, both elected officials, think tankers, opinion leaders, who wished, hoped for more rank-and-file citizen input into American foreign affairs, that someday American foreign policy wouldn't be the work of a highly trained, highly educated, and removed elite, that it wasn't just a conversation that happened in the CEO suites and the cabinet rooms, but something that people talked about regularly. Is that a pipe dream? Is, short of crisis, a regular folk going to talk about foreign affairs, short of war, short of calamity? Will they talk about, well, hey, what are we doing in Africa? What are we doing in Latin America?
I don't know if it's a pipe dream, Ray, but I think that possibility is, at least on the foreign policy side, pretty remote. I think that the American people, if you look at where they rank, as you point out, you know, foreign affairs on the list of issues that might figure into a midterm election, it's, you know, usually number 9 or 10. I don't foresee that changing anytime soon. Part of that is the American character. We tend to be not necessarily isolationist, but isolated. We have two big oceans, and people are able to go about their business. One thing I think that does play into this, though, is the fact that we have, and this is sort of a different topic, and I don't want to get too far off on it, but we have divorced our military activities largely from the American body politic. In other words, by having an all-volunteer force, it is really easy for people to not have a stake in, you know, what's going on internationally. And when we do have people in far-flung places, they're considered to be these days more the professional military class rather than, you know, some kid who from Brooklyn who got drafted. You know, so I think that that's an important question that we, and I've talked with some of our military folks about what that means for the potential for foreign policy leaders to oversteer in ways that go beyond what the American body politic wants, what the American body politic will bear.
Is some of this the responsibility, is some of this the shortcoming of elected officials who, frankly, haven't done a very good job of explaining what this country does in the rest of the world or why?
Yes, it is. I think that's a leadership question, but politicians are going to go where the votes are. And that is the reality. I think that there are politicians who do a better job of it. You know, my old boss, you know, Bob Corker, he could go back to Tennessee and he would talk about foreign policy issues and explain to people how what happens abroad really does affect their lives. How much purchase that gets among American voters is, you know, questionable. And it's not a question of, I don't think, whether or not American voters care or don't care about foreign policy. It's a matter of what they put a priority on. And their priority is their day-to-day lives. And, you know, whether it's inflation or the economy or crime, it's these domestic issues that affect them every day. Now, you can marry up the two, but they're still going to be voting on those top, typically domestic issues.
Chris Tuttle is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, where he heads the Renewing America Initiative. Thanks for being with us on Shifting Ground.
Thanks very much, Ray.
You've been listening to On Shifting Ground, produced in partnership with KQED with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. Today's episode was produced by Elise Manoukian, Andrew Steltzer, and Matteo Schimpf. Research and fact-checking was provided by Elise Manoukian. It was mixed and mastered by Matteo Schimpf. KQED's Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Philip Young, CEO of World Affairs. Thank you for listening.